Hello and welcome along to the New Music Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Adam Tinney and I'm joined here in this special episode today. This is the first special I've recorded with magnificent Paul Hendy.
Hello
Thank
there.
You. Thank you for coming along, Paul.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
I appreciate your time. So we obviously met personally during my day job with filmmaking. So today's episode is not about music. It's just about you and some stories from the entertainment business and stuff that you're doing now, basically. So any listeners who are tuned in for the music stuff, just switch to next week's episode, but I can assure you it's going to be quite interesting.
Yeah, don't ask me to play anything. I can play the drums, actually, if you want me to play
really?
The drums, but that's it.
Well, actually, with the podcast usually finishes with a five-minute song challenge, so 5 minutes to write an original song. Fancy that?
I can do a drum solo. Five-minute drum solo, like the end of Whiplash.
I love it. That'd be amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So basically, just to give an intro into you, Paul, and things we're going to touch on today. So, obviously, early in your career, you were kids TV. You were on BBC, was it?
I was on BBC and ITV. I used to do the old-fashioned broom cupboard.
That's right. That's what
on
I remember.
BBC, and I did the Disney Club, which... Yeah. At the time, was a dream job. It was my first big job in television.
Right, right.
It was a Sunday morning kids show on ITV, and it was for Disney, which meant I get to go all around the world filming these little bits. Yeah, we went to Disney World and Disneyland and Euro Disney, as it was then called. It was that was my break, if you like, and it was a great job. It was a 3-year contract. I mean, you just don't get 3-year contracts these days. So that was a big break for me.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, rather than just trying to touch on all the bits we're going to do, let's just go through it. So we'll just start there, if that's okay with you. So what sort of age were you when you were doing the kids
stuff?
How
old was I? Well, actually, it was relatively... late, I would call it late, because I was mid-20s probably. I was trying to get into television for years and years from when I was about 17. In fact, going back even further, I think I knew when I was 11, I used to watch television. There was a programme, you're far too young, Adam, but there was a programme called Tiz Wars.
I remember that, yeah. I don't remember watching it, but I know of it, obviously.
Yeah,
it's culturally pretty famous.
Oh, it was brilliant. It really was. So to actually be a kid watching this chaos every Saturday morning.
Absolutely.
It was brilliant. If your listeners haven't seen Tiz Wars, it's all on YouTube.
Wasn't it with...
Chris Tarrant,
that's right, of course. That was his first
name. Chris Tarrant and Sally James.
Yeah.
And they just used to throw buckets of water and custard pies. And I used to sit there as an 11-year-old watching this on a Saturday morning thinking... Yeah. That looks brilliant. And I knew then, these people are getting paid money, probably big money, to do this. And I just thought, it seems like a great job. So from when I was about 11, I thought, I want to work in television. But I was from a place called Telford in Shropshire.
Okay.
And people from Telford in Shropshire don't get on the telly, you know. So I didn't really know what or how to get into telly.
Was it quite a hard sort of transition? Because I suppose you sort of think, if you're in London, it's easier. But, you know, talent comes from all over the country, surely, in any generation.
And of course, bear in mind, this was the mid-1980s, I guess, when I really started trying. And these days, everybody wants to be famous. And not only everybody wants to be famous, everybody thinks they can be famous. And quite rightly so, most of them can be.
Yeah.
But in those days, in the mid-80s, it was sort of like, well, you had to be able to do something.
Yeah, of course,
To get on television. So what I did was the old-fashioned sort of what I would call variety route.
Right.
I worked on holiday parks as a sort of blue-coat entertainer.
Right,
and
okay.
I was hosting glamorous granny competitions and knobbly knees competitions.
Wonderful.
And yeah, very often the same person would win both of those competitions, it seems. So I sort of did lots of holiday park work and would do pantomimes as a performer in the winter. So that's quite what I would call an old school route.
Mm.
But at the same time, I was writing off to all these TV companies just saying, look, I want to be a presenter, how do I get this break? You know, and if you know what it's like, if you write enough and if you try and you knock on enough doors. I used to get hundreds and hundreds of rejections.
Did you really?
Yeah. And
did you have to go and audition and then get rejected afterwards?
Rejected after that. But you know, there was something. If I had one talent, because I think I only had one talent. My one talent was that I just didn't take no.
Really?
For an answer. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, I think, genuinely would have given up. And I just had this self-belief, I think, whether it was misguided or not. I look back now, because I'm a producer now, so I get to work with genuinely talented people all the time, and I look back and think, I wasn't this talented, because I wasn't. I'm not, this isn't, you know, false modesty. I know I wasn't. I work with people who can sing and dance, and they look great, and I look back and think, where on earth did my self-confidence come from? I haven't got a clue. And to this day, I don't know.
That's amazing.
It was, but I'm glad I had it because that's what I did have. Because I just thought, no, I'm going to do this. And I kept on going until somebody eventually said, okay, and I got a break. Just before the Disney Club on a very small TV show, and then eventually got the Disney Club, which was a big show, and then got a big agent, and then it all went from there.
I wonder if it may be, you know, kind of fast forwarding to today, and obviously you're on the other side of it now, I guess, with auditioning for the other stuff, which we'll touch on later. And but maybe, would you say it's maybe a bit saturated with talent? It sounds a horrible way to describe it because there is so much talent.
Yeah, do you know what? It's really interesting. I think it is. As I say, you know, Andy Warhol said everybody will be famous for 15 minutes. And I think people believe that now. When he said that, I don't think people did believe it. Your normal working class bloke in the street didn't think they deserved to be on television.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now a lot of people think, well, I could do that with programmes like Big Brother and Gogglebox, which I think is brilliant, you know. But those are just normal people.
Yeah, they are,
watching television and, well, they're stars.
What's the talent?
They're
good at watching TV.
Yeah,
but no, it's entertaining. I get that, you know, that's the point.
It's entertaining. And what is talent? And, you know, what is the X Factor? I don't mean that in the TV show.
Sure,
sense,
sure.
What is it? And who's to say they shouldn't be stars and on television? And it's just I felt... I knew that in the mid-80s before all of that sort of culture, if you like, happened.
Yeah, I had a guy on a few episodes back called Steve Bolton, and he's, well, back in the 70s, he was a guitarist for a band called Atomic Rooster, and he happened to go to a show one night where there was a rumour the Who would be playing, and they were, and he talked to them, and off the back of that, he got a sort of guest spot on one of their tours 10 years later. I think his band did a warm-up for them as well a couple of times. I think maybe the access was a bit easier maybe back then, you know, and someone like yourself who's got a very good personality, you know, I think that helps as well, right? Because you create relationships
that way. I think that's definitely part of it. And just this thing of just never giving up.
Yeah,
I think that's maybe if there is a formula for success, it's talent. You know, you've got to have a little bit of talent.
Yeah.
But it's also ambition. You've got to want it. You know, it's no good having talent and then thinking, I don't want to do that. Then also, you know, the missing ingredient, if you like, I think is drive. That drive to make it happen. Because you can have talent, you've got that. You've got ambition. Yeah, I want to do it. But having the drive to make
absolutely.
It happen. I think those are the three key ingredients. And to be honest, I think drive is probably the most important. You know, because without drive, it very rarely does it happen without that drive.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the musicians I kind of get through the doors here on the Seaside Session sofa where I record musicians, and a lot of younger sort of generation, sort of, you know, late teens, early 20s, maybe to mid 20s, a couple that are a little bit older, but it's very much in the 20s sort of region, you know. And I see some of them that that maybe don't have the confidence, or some of them that, like you say, don't really have the drive. They like what they do, but they're not pushing themselves to do it.
Yeah.
But I see some of them that come in that are so professional, and they really approach it almost like a business. You know, their band and their brand is everything to them. You know,
I think you've got to actually. I think that's really important. And you hit the nail on the head saying business. You know, it's show business. Even the music business is the music business, with the business side being underlined. And I know some people who are artists with a capital A, you know, may not think like that and don't like to think like that.
Yeah.
But I think if you're creating art, you want as many people to see it or to hear it as possible.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So coming off the back of the holiday park soon, you got the Disney gig, which was dream come true, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah, because all of a sudden, and this was at a time, Emma, you did have satellite television, but it wasn't quite as dissipated as it is now. You know, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of channels.
Too many.
This wasn't the days when there were only four channels, but in those days, people still watched BBC and ITV in their millions. So to be doing a kids show on ITV Sunday morning, that was a dream come true for me.
I wonder what the viewers... Do you know the viewer numbers? It must have been more than some primetime things today.
Well, maybe. Yeah, I really don't know. But it was great. You know, I thought, wow, this is what I've wanted to do. And I was like, as I say, I was about 24 and 25 and travelling the world, filming a show for Disney. Then that was going out on Sunday mornings. And then I was also, because I was always a bit of an entertainer, I used to do gigs as well. And I remember once I got a live Saturday morning show, and I drove from that live Live Saturday morning show down to the coast, and I did a gig that night on a holiday park, and it was like, I genuinely felt I'm living the dream here.
Absolutely.
It might seem a bit sad that, but no, actually, but I remember.
If you had a vision from the 11 years of age to be doing that, and then you were doing it,
and
I
it
mean,
really was that, and I was thinking, this is great.
Yeah.
I love it. I love doing this job.
Do you get the sort of thrill from being on stage as well, or like would you pick in the studio or on stage? Have you got a preference?
You know what? At the moment, funnily enough, because I still do the odd bit. I'm a writer, director, producer now, so I've pretty much stopped performing, and I genuinely don't miss it at all. And I was offered a gig today, and I hardly ever do gigs. And my wife said, "Oh, these people have phoned, and do you want to do this gig?" And I was like, "Do you know what? I'm not sure if I do. It's not in me anymore. You know, there's something, if you go into the psychology of it, I guess, about just wanting to show off. I guess
there's something
to do with that.
I guess
and
that
I
makes
just
sense.
Don't feel the need to do that anymore. I'm not driven to do that."
Sure.
That word again, drive. You know, I'm not driven to show off anymore. But, you know, occasionally I do think, well, yeah, I can still get up and I can still go and do an hour if I need to.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that's a very small
part. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Go on, I'll do it. Yeah, go on. It's like maybe a musician who moves on to be a producer and doesn't play anymore. But then occasionally they pick the guitar up and go,
it's just,
it's still
just there.
You know,
yeah, I've got you.
So,
absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So one of my notes that I've made is just the word gunge. With an exclamation mark there, because I'd like to know about the gunge. I've never had gunge on me, but I hear it's quite a difficult thing to remove.
Once again, another dream come true.
Oh, really?
There used to be a kids show called Get Your Own Back with a presenter called Dave Benson Phillips, who's a great, great guy, great personality.
Yeah.
And I was once a guest on Get Your Own Back, and they gunge. I mean, not just gunge, they totally cover you in gunge. And once again, if that's on your bucket list, which it was for me, take that off. I was gunged on television. You know, they used to dunk you in this great vat of gunge. And it was like, it was brilliant. Well, you know, growing up watching, once again, Tiz was, and then later shows like, I think it was Noel's House Party and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
If you like light entertainment, you've got to have a bit of gunge. And I can say I was gunged. I was very happy with that. Very happy.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. I saw there was a kind of a skit online recently on Facebook. It was kind of taking off a show from the 90s, and they had the gunge on them, and they were just sort of saying, it just burns. It's in my ears and everything, and it's burning.
Yeah, I can't remember. It actually wasn't too bad. I was, once again, just happy to be there.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Just genuinely
yeah.
thrilled to think, this is what all I've ever wanted.
Yeah.
And I remember having a moment, a sort of an epiphany, if you like. I remember later on, after I'd done a bit of kids' telly, I did a show called Don't Try This at Home. Which
I was just going to move on, actually. Yeah. So I wonder if there was a... Did it go straight from kids' TV to primetime? Because that was a big deal, that TV show, right?
Yeah, once again. Yeah, so I did kids' TV for about 7 or 8 years, but always looking to move on. Once again, I was quite ambitious and quite driven. And I eventually got a break on a show called Don't Try This at Home, which was a Saturday night primetime show
primetime.
With Davina McCall, who was brilliant and was such a massive star then. I mean, she still is. And I was the sort of, you know, the one who did all the stupid stunts, basically going around getting people doing silly things. But I remember, and this was a filming at LWT, you know, as was. It's called London Studios. In fact, I think they're selling that now. So that's
that
not
right?
going to exist, I think. Yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
But that was legendary, LWT, the studios there. And I remember sitting in the number 2 dressing room at LWT, and I was in number 2, and Davina McCall was in number 1. And I remember thinking and looking in the mirror and having a real moment of clarity where I thought, this is it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Saturday night primetime TV show.
It doesn't get bigger if you're presenting,
well, do you know
right?
what? I suppose it gets bigger if you're in dressing room number 1.
Oh, well, okay, yeah.
But this was my moment of clarity where I genuinely thought, you know what? I know I'm not Davina McCall, obviously. No, but I know I haven't got what Davina has got. So I remember thinking, yeah, this is it. This is probably as big as it gets for me in this. But you know what? I was happy with that. I remember thinking, you know, because 10 years earlier, if you'd have said, you'll be in number 2, dressing room number 2 at LWT and Saturday night primetime show, would you take that? Well, of course I would have done. And it was almost enough for me. And that was when I started doing other stuff. I started writing more and directing more. Not that
right.
I gave up on it, but I really felt, oh, well, I've ticked that box. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was
absolutely.
Quite a sort of moment for me going, it's probably not going to get much better than this.
That's great, isn't it? To have that moment for your whole career to have that sort of precipice, I guess, moment of like, you know,
this
is...
Yeah, and that was still relatively early, and, you know, I've done other stuff
course,
since
yeah.
then, but nothing in terms of entertainment as big as that. I'd sure. say. So yeah.
So on that show, you did the shopping challenge, right? Is that what they called it?
They sort of called. Yeah, I did a couple of different things. It was yeah. I think
you'd have to convince someone to do something.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, then you had to do it yourself.
You've done your research.
I did do a little
very
bit of research.
Good,
yeah.
Very good. It's a bit scary.
I remember the show actually. I remember watching the show, but I couldn't remember the exact details of it. Yeah. But of course, YouTube's a great resource.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So exactly. So I'd have to go up to people in shopping centres and in high streets and go up to them and try and get them to do something silly.
Yeah.
And if they wouldn't do it, I'd do it myself. Exactly. There was one moment which was actually voted. You know, Dennis Norden. No, Dennis Norden used to be the host of It'll Be All Right on the Night.
Yeah, of course.
All the outtakes.
Yeah, yeah.
He voted this clip his all-time funniest clip. Really? They did 40 years of It'll Be All Right on the Night or whatever. And the clip they ended it on was my clip, which Dennis Norden said, this is my all-time favourite.
Amazing.
And it was me going round a shopping centre. And I think I'm allowed to say this. Well, I was trying to get people to eat sheep's testicles.
Okay.
That was the challenge, you know. Sheep's testicle. And if they didn't do it, I had to do it. That was the thing. And I went up to this one guy who was a foreign guy. And I said, excuse me, sir, are you peckish? And he looked at me, he said, no, I'm Turkish. Now, when it was done, totally, that wasn't...
Just
scripted.
Totally off the cuff.
He just turned around and went, no, I'm Turkish. He was like, no, you can imagine the film crew and all of it. And also my expression was
of course.
Totally like... Look to camera.
I love it. Do you know, because you sort of feel sometimes with TV in, you know, 2018 that a lot of it is they might have got a reaction and they might have, oh, can we go back again and just make sure we get that?
I think it's a lot of that. Yeah.
But, you know, I love those kind of like candid ones where you've just got, so what, I presume you had, what, three or four people behind you, camera, lights, sound.
Exactly.
And just you, and that's it, running around everywhere.
And I used to like that as well, that thing of just being able to do that and trying to create something out of nothing.
You know,
that was quite an exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty ballsy to take that challenge on, right? To take that role on, I mean, what kind of things did you have to do? I vaguely remember there was a tightrope walk across something.
That was Davina.
Was that Davina? Was that?
She was in a mini moke.
Right. Okay.
Her little cars, you know, she had to drive a mini moke.
Right.
Two tightropes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, she had a harness on, but
yeah, of course,
still quite,
but still.
Like, oh, yeah, it was quite full on. Some of the stuff.
What about
did.
Yourself? Any of the thing that kind of springs to
I
mind?
I had to have my legs waxed, was one thing. I had to eat maggots, was another thing. You know, it was pretty sort of ridiculous.
Just
stuff.
The sort of stuff that no one really wants to do.
Saturday night fair, but at the same time, quite fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, I mean, I did look online about the Wheel of Fortune, the final series of Wheel of Fortune. So. Yes. I mean, we don't want to say that it obviously wasn't because of you, right?
Well,
surely the numbers were going down already.
Well, put it this way. It was on for 23 years. I did one series and they cancelled it and it's never been back. And that was about 15 years ago.
I mean, Wheel of Fortune, like anyone in the world listening to this will probably know that because it's big in America, right?
Yeah.
It's a huge franchise.
Oh, when I got it, this, you know, I thought Don't Try This at Home was a big break, but to be hosting the Wheel of Fortune was like, wow, this really is it. Now, by then, it was... It was a daytime show.
Oh, okay.
It was definitely slipping, shall we say. it wasn't the glory years that I did, but I did the last series. I killed the Wheel of Fortune. I'm very proud of that. I did a lot of people a good turn there. Did one episode of 12, maybe 20. I mean, we recorded, so I must have done about 26 episodes, something like that.
Wow.
And the first one went out, and this is a bit sad, this, but on the day of the 9/11.
Oh, really?
Not only at the time, they interrupted my show. This is the sort of look I have.
Was it live TV?
So it wasn't live. No,
oh, it was pre-recorded. Okay, but they interrupted the show.
But they interrupted the show, and not only the show, but my first show.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, you know, Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, right.
And literally as it started, and you can sort of check the time, it must have been about 2:40 in the afternoon, something like that. And they interrupted to go to ITN, as
of course,
they do.
Yeah.
And they had the terrible atrocity that was 9/11.
Oh,
so
God. Talking about a bit of foreboding for,
not
for the series.
Bit of a downer, that story, isn't it?
Yeah,
but it was just my luck. You know, it was sort of,
goodness.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. Wow. All right, so I think let's talk about a bit more to the present. So, of course, the first thing I knew you from was the film. The Last Laugh, mm-hmm. Which was about the three comedians. Maybe you should just tell the synopsis. So this is the film, first film that you made,
which was
submitted to the film festival I work for.
Yeah. So. And you chose it. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. It won an award. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. Yeah, I've always been a massive film fan. And interestingly, I think if I had my time again, to be honest, I wouldn't change anything.
Of course.
But I wish I'd spent more time directing along the way as well,
okay.
and not just performing, because it's something I get so much pleasure from now, writing and directing and producing as well. I work in theatre a lot, but film is very much a passion for me. I just love it. I love the whole creative process. You know, when I do a lot of theatre, and when it's theatre, you know, the audience, they see the full picture, and they can look where they want to look,
right?
You know, so if they want to look at this actor when he's standing over here, or that actor when he's standing over, or that dancer standing at the back there, they can do that. Whereas a filmmaker has total control. Maybe it's about control, I don't know. And if they don't want you to look over there, the filmmaker doesn't let you look over
there.
That's
a good point.
They tell you exactly where to look, and it's such a collaborative process. I really like it even more than theatre. Really, you know, the people you work with, the director of photography, the editor, the sound guys, the sound mix that you do, and it can all change how the audience sees it. Just when you bring the music in, you know, you could bring it in on this shot here, or you could change it and bring it in on this shot here, and it totally changes it. And you could cut to this close-up here. If there's a two shot of us talking now, the camera I'm the one talking, so you'd think, oh yeah, put the camera on Paul on a close-up. But the more interesting thing might be to put the camera
my
on
reactions
you,
to what you're
your
saying.
Reaction. You falling asleep while I'm talking. No, but do you know what I mean? It's sort of you as the director of a film get to make those decisions.
Yeah.
And I genuinely love that. So for a long time, I was looking for an idea for a film. I've always been a massive fan of comedy. I've always been a huge fan of Eric Morecambe and Tommy Cooper. And I just happen to know two actors who work for me in my day job, and they are just like Eric Morecambe and Tommy Cooper. You know, they are them. The guy who plays Eric Morecambe in my film, we're all good friends with Gary Morecambe, who's the son of Eric Morecambe,
right?
And Gary says about Bob, the guy who plays Eric, he says he's my dad. So
really,
so for Gary Morecambe, the son of Eric Morecambe, to be saying he is my dad,
and it doesn't get much higher praise than that, does it?
He really is. So Bob Golding is brilliant as Eric Morecambe, and Damien Williams is brilliant as Tommy Cooper. So I had these two actors who were, and I kept thinking, I just want to do something with these guys. I want to do a film about these guys, about Tommy Cooper and Eric Morecambe, but I couldn't get an angle on it. And then Bob Golden, who plays Eric Morecambe, he said to me, I've got this amazing actor. I know this guy who's amazing at Bob Monkhouse.
Right.
Now, nobody does Bob Monkhouse. He's quite difficult to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I went to see this show, which this guy was doing, starring as Bob Monkhouse, an actor called Simon Cartwright. And it was like, wow, he's Bob Monkhouse. So suddenly, I had Eric Morecambe, Tommy Cooper, and Bob Monkhouse. And I thought, what would it be like, these three guys in a dressing room, discussing the secret of comedy, because they actually had different approaches to comedy.
Yeah, of course.
To comedy. Eric and Tommy were very naturally funny men, whereas Bob Monkhouse, he was much more of a sort of a thinker. He would really have to hone a gag. He wasn't necessarily naturally funny. If you were sitting in a group of people, you know, you wouldn't be the one, hey. But he sort of studied comedy a lot more. So I just wanted to do a film about what would it be like, a fictional film about if these three guys, these three legends of comedy, were sitting in a dressing room discussing the secret of comedy. And that's what I made. And did really well at the film festivals all around the world. You know, it won awards in Los Angeles, which, you know,
amazing.
They haven't got a clue who they said.
Well, they're very British comedians, right?
Very British names. They didn't know. They thought I'd made these characters up.
Oh, really?
Literally on the red carpet. You know, they interview the red carpet. Somebody says, so where did you get the idea for these characters from? It's like, so I said, oh yeah, I just made them up. You know, just came to me. So,
fantastic.
That's great. I loved that whole process, and I'm working on another film now as well about the life of Eric Morecambe.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so you're trying to draw in the inspirations from what you've already done then.
That's
wonderful.
But taking it one stage further, I'm going to shoot another short, but make it more like a trailer, and it's going to be called Mr. Sunshine, and it's about the life of Eric Morecambe, but I'm hopefully going to use that trailer to try and raise finance for a feature film of the same name. A couple of years ago, I produced a play about the life of Eric Morecambe. So it's that, brilliantly written by a guy who's won a BAFTA and an Olivier.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's top quality, the writing.
Brilliant.
And Bob will play Eric Morecambe again. So that's the project I'm working on at the moment, which is very exciting.
Very exciting, exciting. And of course, your ongoing projects, of course, is shall we say, the biggest panto in the UK? I don't want to blow your own trumpet there too much, but it's massive, right? Your pantos are huge.
Well, there's certainly some of the biggest in the UK, yeah. So my wife and I run a company called Evolution Productions, and we produce pantomimes. That's my day job, if you like. So we produce pantomimes. I write and direct them. And these days, a lot of people don't realise it's actually quite a big business now. And to produce a sort of, let's say, Premier League pantomime, it takes all year.
Of course,
to put one on. And our show in Canterbury, the Marlowe Theatre in Canterbury, is one of the biggest in the country. Last year's show, Peter Pan, was seen by 100,000 people.
Oh, you told me this before when you came in earlier. It just kind of blew me away.
Oh, it's amazing. Because... Yeah, well, there's only 46,000 people in Canterbury. I think they all went twice. You know, so that's great, and we're very proud of the reputation, and we produce shows like that all over the country. So, and it's great. I love it. I mean, as much as I love film and I used to love performing, I was talking to my wife this morning. I said, you know what? I still love it. We still get up every day and we're still excited by it. And because it's good fun.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
It's really good fun. It's a laugh, you know.
Absolutely. So obviously, you know, with the panto, you actually work with a friend of mine, Lloyd. He's in all of your pantos.
Yes,
Lloyd
Holliday.
I grew up opposite him in the same
did
road.
You? Yes.
I did, yeah, yeah. And of course, you have Stephen Mulhern as well. And so you get a few names on the circuit. And I'm sure there's a number of different things that have led to the reputation. You've got, obviously, quality first and foremost. You've had a few names as well, though. You know, how does that kind of work? Was that straight out the bat? You had showbiz friends, maybe, that you got involved?
A little bit of both. Ultimately, for the bigger names in pantomime, it's hard work. I mean, a lot of people don't realise, you know, two shows a day, three shows on a Saturday, only one day off a week. That, you know, it's
quite
hard work.
Schedule.
So we do pay well. Yep. You know, we have to offer a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully the shows will take a lot of money in return. So it becomes, you know, the business. Talking about business again, you know, there's a bottom line, so you have to get that right. But yeah, I think people enjoy it. It's good fun when they're doing it. There's a real family sort of feeling that you get when you're doing pantomimes.
And you keep a lot of the same core team together.
A lot of the guys. So I've got Lloyd, as you say, works for us every year in Canterbury, alongside a guy called Ben Roddy, who's our dame there, who's got a great reputation. And I've got the sort of equivalent of Ben and Lloyd, if you like, in each of my eight shows. So I've got a resident comedian or dame in each of the shows. And they're sort of, I like to call them grassroots stars. They may not be on the television, they may not be celebrities, as you might say, but the local audience know them. You know, and they know the local audience.
Yeah,
and that's really important, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. It is, you kind of get that engagement, especially with the local audience, you know, in a place like Canterbury that's very kind of arts led.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really wonderful. Yeah. And how does the writing kind of work with that? Because obviously a lot of these guys, like Lloyd, I know, does a lot of comedy tours himself.
He
you know, supports Jim Davidson all the time.
Do
they write a lot of the gags or the jokes and the stories, or do you get involved mostly in that?
Yeah, I write the scripts, so I write all of our scripts. I mean, it becomes collaborative during the rehearsal process, but I'm quite tight on the scripts, and I know that I know what the guys who work for me are like, so I know what sort of material they like. So yeah, it's a collaborative process, but ultimately I write the script because I enjoy doing that.
It's another thing I
quite like.
And is that is like a year-long process? I mean, presumably you've already started on the 2018 panto.
Not yet. I start writing the scripts in September.
Okay.
Yeah, and the build-up to it. So I'm sort of collecting jokes, if anybody knows any jokes. Got to be clean.
Yeah, tweet them in.
Yeah, but, you know, sort of collecting jokes and then start putting them together.
Okay.
But it is a year, the actual producing the shows is a year-long process because, you know, you've got all the sets and costumes.
Right, of course.
And then all the, you know, the design of the posters, the casting. At the moment, I'm casting, so speaking to agents all day long trying to get people interested in the shows.
Yeah.
And obviously we need some big stars, but for them to commit this early, so
yeah, of course.
So then you offer them more money and you hopefully get there. Yeah.
So you've literally come full circle. So that is where you are now. You're on the other side of that casting desk.
Yeah.
Those 17-year-olds with a dream.
Yeah. Do you
know
what?
That's where you are now.
That's what I think, as I said, you know, we've come back to where we started, because I do see a lot of people like me coming in, and they are more talented than me. They are. Not, as I say, it's like, wow, how did I do what I did? Well, it comes back to me saying about, I was driven, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I say to people. If you want to do it, people say, oh, what advice have you got? It's like, be driven.
Yeah.
Because the minute you stop being driven, there's somebody else coming up on the inside lane.
Absolutely.
Who is very, very driven. So, and I was that guy. I was the guy on the inside lane, you know? So,
absolutely. Yeah,
I'm
absolutely.
Sure a lot of people looked at me back in the day, well, how did he get? How did he get on? You know, and it's like, because I didn't stop, you know.
Yeah,
some people might get 10 rejections and think, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas I...
It could be quite disheartening, I suppose, getting that many, but...
Whereas I don't remember. I mean, I certainly was rejected a lot, but I don't remember getting disheartened. I remember just thinking, right, the next one then, and the next one, and just kept on knocking.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's wonderful. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Wonderful.